Hey, 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 this is Yoki. If you guys see Boo-Boo, tell him Mr. Ranger's wearing a gun.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, and tonight is the third night in our series with a man who assembled the information, wrote, edited, and published Goodbye, April 15th. Welcome once again, Boston Tea Party.
Thank you, Bill.
And don't go away, folks. We're going to be right back one more night in your continuing education.
Delta House?
Sure. Come on in.
Good evening, everyone. This is Boston Tea Party, author of Goodbye, April 15th. First night I talked about terms in the Internal Revenue Code, U.S. citizen, income, wages, things of this sort. Last night I talked about how wages were not taxable in principle. They're your right to keep. You earn them by the sweat of your brow. Tonight I'm going to talk about the purpose of the income tax. I mentioned, I think the first night, that the income tax doesn't go, not a penny of it goes to the roads, not a penny goes to defense and that sort of thing. But don't take my word for it. You can take someone's word for it, a guy named Beardsley Rummel. And whenever I read that guy's name, it just makes me smile inside. He was one of Rockefeller's main boys. From 1937 to 1946, Beardsley Rummel was chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, which is obviously the most powerful of the system's banks. Since the government could rely on the Federal Reserve and its irredeemable FRNs, or FERNs, for revenue, Rummel said that the federal income tax should instead be used to achieve certain, quote, social and economic consequences. Well, gee, what could these be? Well, I'll let Rummel himself explain. Four things he said they should be used for. Number one, as an instrument of fiscal policy to help stabilize the purchasing power of the dollar. What that means is to conceal inflation. Basically, the Federal Reserve pumps in massive amounts of new ferns every year, and if they allowed us to keep those ferns, we'd spend them, of course, which would drive up prices, people competing on the market with more ferns in their pocket.
Just in case there's some listeners out there who don't know what ferns are, could you explain that?
Federal Reserve notes. The New York banks call them FRAUDs, Federal Reserve Accounting Unit devices, or frauds, which is a pretty good term in itself. So the first reason for the income tax to achieve social and economic consequences is to conceal inflation. The Federal Reserve pumps in Federal Reserve notes, and the income tax takes them right out of your pocket before you can spend them. They do that through the withholding scam at your job site. Second reason, to express public policy in the distribution of wealth and of income, as in the case of the progressive income and estate taxes. What that means is replace the middle class with a welfare class. A middle class has always been the backbone of any country. When you have a thin or impoverished middle class, you have an impoverished nation. Mexico, to the south of us, their middle class is getting stronger, therefore the country is. Our middle class is decreasing. Everybody knows it. Our standard of living has peaked in 1973 and declined ever since then. That's why young families can't afford new homes. They're living in trailers. They're staying with their parents. We all know these symptoms. Number three, to express public policy in subsidizing or in penalizing various industries and economic groups. Well, what that is, obviously, is political favoritism and oppression. The income tax is used for that. Number four, to isolate and assess directly the costs of certain national benefits, such as highways and Social Security. Well, that's a pretty thin number four, but they throw it in there to make it look good. Highways and Social Security, many free market economists argue that these things could be privately provided for by the free enterprise system. Quoting Beardsley Rummel in his final little synopsis, by all odds, the most important single purpose to be served by the imposition of federal taxes, meaning income taxes, is the maintenance of a dollar which has stable purchasing power over the years. Sometimes this purpose is stated as, quote, the avoidance of inflation. Funds the government spends becomes purchasing power in the hands of the people who have received them, whereas funds confiscated by taxation cannot be spent by the people, and therefore can no longer be used to acquire the things which are available for sale. Without the use of federal income taxation, all other means of dollar stabilization, such as monetary policy and price controls and subsidies, are unavailing. By the way, it was Beardsley Rummel who designed the private sector wage withholding scam. So there you have it, from as top a government official as you'll ever hear from about the purpose of the income tax. It's not to pay for roads, defense, the maintenance of our infrastructure. It's for social and economic consequences, to conceal inflation, to replace the middle class with a welfare class, as a tool of political favoritism and oppression, and to provide for so-called national benefits, which should be in the hands of free enterprise. In your wallets, since 1990, you might have noticed a new kind of Federal Reserve note. The 1990 series had a little strip in them on the left-hand side, about a third in from the left-hand side. It's a little, what is it made of? Polyester with platinum letters on it. This is a hybrid paper electronic money that I talked about in my book. They want to go to a cashless system, which I'll talk about in a bit. But right now we just have a paper system, so they have to have a hybrid, a papery electronic medium that can be tracked by machines where they know who spent the money to you and who you spend it to, and eventually they'll ease this whole system into a cashless economy, culminating, they hope, in a debit card and a number system. The two-tiered FRN, which I talked about in my book when it came out 2 years ago, is a reality. What I mean by two-tiered is that we're going to have a domestic Federal Reserve note and an international one. Let me talk about this a bit. To make sure that we have a captive monetary audience, the banksters plan on circulating this new FRN only within the national borders, while the old FRNs will continue to circulate overseas. At the time of the initial swap from the greenback we're familiar to the new greenback, this initial swap, the ratio will have to be 1-to-1 to avoid widespread revolt, panic, and just disobedience. Once the swap is accomplished and the sheep are munching on what I call new grass, the Fed will turn up the printing presses, and I'm making a broad generalization. They'll turn up the printing presses as never before and hyperinflate the new Federal Reserve note. It is this currency that the retiring baby boomers will receive as their, quote, Social Security checks. Many people have written about this. Martin Essman has, and How to Achieve Personal and Financial Privacy in a Public Age. Dr. Ron Paul in the Ron Paul Money Book. And now we're seeing copies of this new note being distributed, being shown. USA Today had it, I think, the May 10th issue. All the coin magazines are bantering about this new note and how beautiful it's going to be and whether Benjamin Franklin should be on the right side or the left side of the $100 bill. Who cares? Who cares? It's to create a new monopoly money, a money we can only spend domestically within the borders. When you want to fly overseas and take some cash with you at the airport, there'll be exchange counters there, and you'll exchange your domestic fraud for an international fraud. So trying to get your liquid assets out of the country once this two-tier currency is in effect will be much more difficult. Well, some of you are probably thinking, can all this really happen? Well, you bet it can. In fact, something very similar occurred here just 50 years ago. After the 1941 bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hawaiians frantically withdrew their savings from banks in fear of the anticipated Japanese invasion. Although that invasion never came, the Hawaiian banks nearly collapsed from the run. Accordingly, 1 month later, the U.S. military police outlawed the holding of more than $200 in cash, and violators were subject to fines and imprisonment. All so-called surplus dollars were to be turned in to the government for, quote, safekeeping. That's Orwellian, isn't it? And to enforce this provision, the MPs inspected safety deposit boxes for contraband cash and confiscated all that was found. Then the MPs mandated a currency swap for a new Federal Reserve note with the word Hawaii imprinted on the reverse. Any coin dealer can show you one of these bills. When the next FRN swap happens, it will be rather familiar to elderly Hawaiians. Well, isn't this for a noble cause? Doesn't the end justify the means? It does if one is a tyrant. Listen to Don Regan speaking in USA Today about this war on drugs and what we have to do in the monetary scheme. A lot of people will raise legal questions. Do we have the right to do this? These people, he's talking about the drug dealers, are killers. We, the feds, have the right to do anything we want to them to protect ourselves. And don't tell me our founding fathers would have never approved or that it's unconstitutional to go after them. It is not. I'm sure that Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or George Washington, had they known of a drug problem, would have gone after them. Bah. Folks, as a friend of mine said, Thomas Jefferson has now been clocked at 3,700 RPM. Thomas Jefferson and Madison and Washington are spinning in their graves over all this. Whenever poverty, crime, or recessions are needed to sell some new tyranny, the feds are perfectly capable of creating poverty, crime, or recessions as a means to their end, and the public buys it. So when you see these new bills come out, and when they say it's to flush out the cash empires of the drug lords, it's a new counterfeiting measure, you'll know it's not true. It's to keep you a domestic, captive, monetary audience, and they can pay their debts off with hyperinflated new domestic dollars. And unless you've converted your assets to gold, unless you've sent them overseas, unless you've converted your assets to commodities, something useful, something real, something not capricious, then you're going to be caught with the old maid. And the government will have quite a bit more leverage over you. So don't let that happen. My book talks about the history of all this, how it dovetails with the income tax, things that are going to happen in the future. So it's very important that you get the book and learn about this, because we don't have much time yet. I expect that the new dollar Federal Reserve note will be out by 95 or 96. It's already been printed up at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, the Mint in Fort Worth. It's a new facility. They can make their own ink. They do all the printing. It's high security, and it's devoted just to this new Federal Reserve note, the domestic one. So learn about it ahead of time and catch on to it before it catches you. Well, we've heard a lot of talk about conspiracies and the money thing and taxes, and it sounds like it's a big grand plan. Well, it is. A guy named Dr. Carol Quigley, who wrote Tragedy and Hope, was one of the big insiders. He had access to all their papers. He knew most of the figures that were planning and instituting this. And he agreed with what they were doing, but he only disagreed in the fact that they were trying to keep it all private, trying to keep it secret. So he wrote an 1,100-page book explaining what their aim was. And their aim, and I'm quoting from his book, Tragedy and Hope, was nothing less to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole, where the individual's freedom and choice will be controlled within very narrow alternatives by the fact that he will be numbered from birth and followed as a number through his educational training, his required military or other public service, his tax contributions, wink, wink, his health and medical requirements, and his final retirement and death benefits. This is the real game Monopoly. This is the big version, the world version. They've even got their own money, the Federal Reserve notes. Rockefeller, John D. Sr., said in 1904, "In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and, unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill, wink, wink, upon a grateful and responsive rural folk." How about a sheep noise here? Bah! Thank you. So we've got Quigley telling you what they're all about. We've got Rockefeller dreaming in his head what this could be all about. We've been seeing the signs for years. And my book puts it together in an understandable, digestible form. And it's actually kind of fun to read. So, the income tax is a method of enslavement. They planned it for decades. We're just not intelligent enough to rule our own lives. We're rubes, sheep, and this thing can happen if we let it. I'm kind of disappointed and disheartened so far up to date with the masses' sense of what I call symbol patriotism. It's a hollow, superficial form of patriotism which reveres the symbols of America instead of the ideals of America. The ideals of America are codified in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution's Bill of Rights. It's this philosophy of freedom, this respect for unalienable rights, limited government, and due process of law, which is America, not the bald eagle. Our founders fought for the Bill of Rights, not the Star-Spangled Banner. If you disagree, ask yourself this: which will more outrage the public, the trampling of their constitutional rights, or the burning of the American flag? Today's symbol patriotism is based on images and emotion. We no longer have a universal patriotism based on the individual knowledge of our rights and our institutions. This explains why Americans work half their lives for government, yet still believe they are free. Just because a slave has weekends off doesn't mean he's two-sevenths free, okay? Just because you're allowed, you know, money to go down to the movies, have something to eat in a restaurant, or take a trip for 2 weeks a year, you think you're free. You're not. We're living in a gilded cage. So, Bill likes that. I'll quote now from Étienne de Lebouthie. He said, "It is incredible how as soon as a people becomes subject, it promptly falls into such complete forgetfulness of its freedom that it can hardly be roused to the point of regaining it, obeying so easily and willingly that one is led to say that this people has not so much lost its liberty as won its enslavement." With our minds turned to TV mush, caring only about luxuries and conveniences, griping about the pizza guy being 5 minutes late, we've allowed this big mess of ours all by ourselves. We won't write a letter to our congressmen or newspapers and editorials protesting this federal tyranny, but gosh, let a soft drink company change its cola formula and the whole country freaks out. Tyranny costs money. We financed this whole thing, this bondage, all by ourselves. And what's been our excuse?
"Well, those IRS meanies would have taken away my new Geo Storm if I didn't do what they said."
Ah.
Yeah. We've got the best-dressed, neatest-driving cars of sheep that ever lived. I've long suspected that this righteous indignation of America is of high temperature, but of low BTUs. Our national anger is white hot, but it goes no further than a needle tip. We are easily quenched. To illustrate what I mean, a quote from Oliver Lang's very American novel, Defiance, which recounts a successful Soviet sneak attack in which America was conquered in a matter of a few weeks. This is a strongly worded passage, but one we all need to hear. Our peril was not the bomb, or communism, or the population explosion, but the state to which our lifestyle had progressed. By some sequence still not clear, the American psyche curdled badly by the 70s. The improvement of our human condition, individually and nationally, our raison d'etre, became perfunctorily mechanical. There was no spirit anywhere. The deeper shock, then, was not that we lost, he's talking about the war, but that we lost with such ease, with an effortless that approached divine imperturbability. In terms of image, the world was presented with the Statue of Liberty, not as an inviolate emblem, but as a vacuously grinning old whore, who after a token assault was debauched and then rolled docilely in the hay. U.S. citizens, including the great silent majority, did not, after all, especially care who led them. What counted was, they did not have to lead themselves. We proved the lie, were served up with a gagging portion of our vintage distillation of apocalyptic BS, all the narcissistic swill about indomitable spirit, invincibility, courage, and nobility of purpose, and demonstrated once and for all to those who looked on with an interest, a fact long suspected, that this nation, through a self-administered indoctrination of spurious righteousness, larded with the false rewards of superfluous luxury, had at last achieved the most tractable, malleable, let's face it, spineless people to walk the face of the earth. Is that us, Americans? Is that our future? There's nothing to guarantee that Americans will remain free. We can turn socialist just like other countries, and we're very close to it. It's all up to us. We're the most naturally patriotic people on earth, and this, indirectly, is our weakness. The 4th of July, the Statue of Liberty, and the red, white, and blue are used as sales props for socialist control and world government. I'll give you an example. The ration coupons of the wholly artificial 1975 fuel shortage cleverly had pictures of George Washington on them. The next time you see some Fed on TV announcing a new bit of tyranny or a new war or police action, look for the American flag behind them. It's always there. I'm going to conclude the three nights of my discussion about government. Its first duty is to do no harm, just like a doctor. Do no harm. You've heard of tax protesters, been thrown out of their house seized, their businesses closed. I'll put it to you this way. There's no purpose of the federal government so compelling, so important, as to throw people out of their houses, close their businesses, break up families for the mere non-payment of taxes. Nothing the government does is that important. What's the point of throwing people out on the streets, closing businesses down, increasing unemployment, when the taxpayers are paying for unemployment benefits, welfare, counseling for people with wrecked lives? What's the point of creating more misery, new misery, just because they, for one reason or another, of social conscience, refuse to pay taxes? We shouldn't need a 400-page book like mine. We shouldn't have needed two dozens of books like this. We should just be outraged at the Gestapo nature of the IRS. We shouldn't need all this legal discussion of the ins and outs of semantics and what is a U.S. citizen. This is a principle involved. We're working for a living, we deserve to take home our wages, and we deserve to have honest Republican form of government, a government that spends its resources on constitutional purposes. And only 26% of what it spends its current dollar on goes to the constitutional limitations of defense, courts, and Congress. 3 cents, 75% out of every dollar goes to the international welfare states, goes to the eternal welfare states, goes to police actions with the UN, whatever. So We shouldn't need this endless discussion, this minutiae of legalistic arguments. Let's go back to the fundamentals. We should have a limited government and limited amounts of money it requires. And that's really the end of it. So think of that first in all things. I've got a few suggestions to you. Do we have time for this, Bill? Okay. All right, we've got 3 minutes. I've got about 8 suggestions to you, and then we'll open the phone lines up for questions. Get out of paper Federal Reserve note assets. I wouldn't have more than $1,000 in cash, and I wouldn't have a single penny in IRAs, 401ks, KIOs, mutual funds, that sort of thing. They're coming down. Convert these things to hard assets, commodities, gold, silver, tools, ammunition, guns, building supplies, medical supplies, and distribute these things geographically. Don't keep them all in your garage. Get out of hollow, debilitating friendships, relationships. Make friends with solid, informed, courageous people, because you're going to have to rely on them in the future, very soon. Get your family and spiritual lives in order, because these are the bedrock. These are the bedrock that we rely upon. Keep your principles visible. Keep your assets hidden. Cultivate some personal privacy for a change. You don't have to talk about what you're doing, what you've got, and where you're going. We don't know what people are going to be doing, motivated by greed, envy, hate, despair. So keep some things to yourself. These things will require some hard changes in your life. Make these hard changes now, because it will be almost impossible to make later. Support your patriots, people like Bill Cooper on the radio, other authors, radio talk shows. We're not making a fortune doing this. We're not in this for the money. We're doing this to try to help you and help us and help change the country. We need your help. Finally, tell others about what you've heard on the radio, about what you've read. This stuff is not going to come over the national media. It's got to be word of mouth. It's got to be grassroots from the ground up. A videotape I recommend highly is called Liberty in the Balance. It's a 60-minute style documentary, about an hour long, on the issues of jurisdiction, Federal Reserve, income taxes, the United Nations. It's available from Mosaic Media, colleagues of mine. Their number is 818-973-3142. Come back with us just after a couple of minutes. We'll open the phone lines for some questions. Thank you.
Can give them to the birds and bees. I want more. I want more. I want
Yes, folks, that's the first thing that anybody ever asks me as I travel around this country and give my little talk, trying to make somebody understand. Basically, the same thing the Boston Tea Party is trying to make you understand tonight. The first question anybody ever asks is, how can I save my assets? Not, how can I save the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or freedom or liberties or become more responsible, but how can I save my assets? If you really understood how economies work, you would have been doing the right thing all along to save your assets. And the first step in saving your assets is to save our liberties, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. These things allow you to have assets. The New World Order, the socialism, well, you know, I think you should do a little work yourself. Look back at what happens to people under socialism, under totalitarian governments. And if you're smart, you'll call our sponsor, Swiss America Trading, right now. And you'll begin to take the proper steps, not just to save your assets, but to save the Constitution, save the Bill of Rights, protect your loved ones, and put a portion of your assets into real money where it should have been all along. You see, you've been conned into using a counterfeit currency. It's not even money, not even, by definition, in your wildest dreams. So call 1-800-289-2646. Tell them that you listen to the Hour of the Time, because if you do, you'll get red carpet treatment. 1-800-289-2646. Ask them how they can help you. Prepare yourself for what's coming. Newspapers. It was in all the coin newspapers. It was in USA Today. It was on the 6 o'clock news. They said very clearly that the currency exchange would be sometime after the first of the year. When exactly? I don't know. Could be as early as sometime between January the 15th and April the 1st. And with the currency change, either comes rapid inflation or the devaluation of the dollar. Call 1-800-289-2646. You know, if you've been listening to the Hour of the Time for quite a while, you already know these things, for I warned you a long, long time ago and told you exactly what was coming and what to expect and how it would affect you. 1-800-289-2646. Do it now. You know how you tend to procrastinate, and you must be prepared. 1-800-289-2646. Some of you who are very aware have noticed the theme for tonight's broadcast. Remember, a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals. Animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. I want you all to stand up right now and raise your right hand. Stand up wherever you're at. Face your radio set and raise your right hand.
I state your name.
I state your name.
Do hereby pledge allegiance to the Pratt.
Do hereby pledge allegiance to the Pratt.
With liberty and fraternity for all.
Amen.
We're back with the Hour of the Time. This is Boston Tea Party. We're going to open the phone lines up in just a second. The first thing I want to do is respond to a reader's question. Chris, he faxed in a question. Can I revoke U.S. citizenship for tax purposes without jeopardizing my defense security clearance, which requires one to be a U.S. citizen? I highly doubt it. They put that term in there, U.S. citizen, for a reason. They want you to be a Fed just like them. And I really don't see any way out of it, so sorry. Okay, Bill's going to give out the phone number for questions. Please call in, ask me anything about the book. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have access to all your papers and what you've sent in to the government and what they've sent you, so I can't give you really any specific advice, but I can give you some general thoughts on procedure, if that's your question.
If you're a new listener, our call-in number is 602-337-2524. That's 602-337-2524. And remember, when we're not on the air, that's our fax number. If you have some information you'd like to fax to us. If you'd like to purchase Mr. Boston Tea Party's book, Goodbye April 15th, send $43. That's $43. Make checks or money orders payable to Annie. A-N-N-I-E. Nothing else. Annie. A-N-N-I-E. $43. Send it to the Intelligence Service. Post Office Box 1420. Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420. Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I was wondering if I could shed some light on a definition of a word that you've used tonight that's really interesting. Have you ever looked up the word discussion in the law dictionary?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's very interesting. It says here, this is for all those people operating as fictitious entities, as franchisees of municipal corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what they're doing to you. It says, in the civil law, a discussion is a proceeding, comma, at the instance of a surety, comma, by which the creditor is obliged to exhaust the property of the principal debtor, comma, towards the satisfaction of the debt, comma, before having recourse to the surety, and this right of the surety is termed the, quote, benefit of discussion, unquote.
Hmm.
Now, just who do you think the surety and the principal debtor are?
Well, I can give one guess. Us. Huh, that's interesting. I'll have to look at that for the next edition of the book. Thanks for bringing that in.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, that quick. Okay, I've got a couple of questions. I've got the book, and I'm questioning how to find information on getting a Lloydium title and quiet title. Also, I'm interested in my father was born in Canada, and my wife was born on a military base.
Hmm.
One was naturalized, and the other one is obviously a U.S. citizen born on a military base. How do they declare American citizenship?
Well, you were born of at least one American parent. He was just a federal American. So you were born an American, also a federal American, and unless you've moved to one of the 50 states and declared your domicile in one of those states to the government will still assume that you're a federal American. So it's just a matter of a little bit of paperwork. That's discussed in Chapter 24, you'll find. You can use that form for your situation. Oh, about the allodial title, I'm still researching that myself. There's a good basic book to get. It's called I Want to Own My Land. It's by Bob Kelly of the American's Bulletin. He's up in Medford, Oregon. And just call information. I don't have the number right here with me. I Want to Own My Land.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, Bill. And your guest, I didn't catch his name. What's his name?
Boston Tea Party.
Boston Tea Party. Listen, my question is this. We've kind of gotten ourselves in quite a jam, at least my mother has. I guess the federal government is trying to get me for income tax. I think I owe them about $1,500, and I'm unemployed, and I'm a full-time student going to school. And I don't have the money to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had co-signed for a house for my sister. And she had to move out because she couldn't afford the rent. She just got behind, and there was about five or six payments behind, and
mm-hmm.
so she finally moved out. And they just served my mother with a notice. They're going to pursue a lawsuit against her. Well, she's retired and on Social Security, and I guess they're coming after her.
On the basis of your debt to
her? Well, not on the basis of my debt, but just on the fact that, you know, she co-signed the house. My situation really doesn't have anything to do with her. But,
okay.
But that, you know, you can see that the government is continually coming down on people.
Sure.
And our cases, or my case is just as, it's similar, you know, in that, you know, the government is coming down on people and trying to destroy their lives.
Certainly.
And but what my I guess my question was is, you know, is that what she wants to do, she wants to hire an attorney, you know, and I guess they've got her scared to death that you know, she's gonna take her to court, and but there's really nothing they can do to her. I mean, what, she doesn't own anything.
Well, let's try and see if we can get an answer, because we've already got the pertinent information that we need. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Well, they certainly can civilly sue her for non-payment, but as you said, if she has no assets, then all they can do is make a nasty remark, judgment in her credit file. So you can't get blood out of a turnip. You can't get assets out of someone that doesn't have them. It's not a pleasant experience being sued civilly, but if that's the only way this thing's probably going to go, and she can't pay it, well, she can't pay it. So tell her not to worry. It's not worth getting upset and losing health over anything like that. That's all I can tell you.
Folks, don't get attached to material possessions. If we lose this battle, you're going to lose it all anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Get into spiritual things. Get into contact and interaction with good, solid people. And as far as this young man's problem is, if you go to the IRS and make arrangements to make payments, you're going to be a lot better off than if you just sit back and wait for them to come and take everything you own, because that's what they'll do. You're using the wrong language, so I know you're going to lose in advance, because on this broadcast you said you owed them at least $12,000, and that's an admission that you're liable. So, you know, you've got a lot of studying to do, and if you were just listening the last two nights, you should have known better than to make that statement. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, fellas.
Good evening.
I'd like to order Boston's book, but I thought I'd check first and see if he would anticipate any special problems for someone who hasn't filed for 10 to 12 years.
Not really. The IRS's computers, what they're using to go after non-filers, basically is a two-part system. It requires, number one, someone to file a form, a 1099 or a W-9, telling the government that you've made some sort of income from somewhere. And the other half of that computer system looks for a return from someone that had income reported on them. And if there's no return and the income exceeded the threshold of the reporting requirement, then the computer kicks that guy's name out and they get a letter saying, hey, where's your 1040? So if you haven't had income reported on you and you haven't had a big fat bank account all these years, they don't know about you. So, no, there's no special problem, and I would say that you're in a better position to use this information to your benefit than other people.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question for you. I have your book, and
thank you.
Enjoy it, reading it very much. It's very, very, very good.
Thank you.
And I have a question. If you file for the 1040 NR forms, as you suggested, which I did, I haven't got very far in recouping any of those funds. Do you know of anybody who has been successful at doing that? And also, I have a question. Do you have any advice for trying to become employed in the loose sense of the word if you do these things that you outlined in your book?
You mean as a private contractor, an independent contractor?
He's not there.
Oh, he's not there. Okay. Getting back to filing for a refund, it's very rare that the government kicks back a refund anymore. They're being swamped with refund requests. Information like this has really gotten out to quite a few people, so the government is just panicky about this. What I would do is just sort of look at the money you paid into the government as sort of a tuition. And let it burn inside you. You know, get hot about it, because if we're not angry about what's been done to us, nothing's going to happen. So unfortunately, we can't really expect refunds from the government. It's nice when it happens. I hear of them once in a while, but it's certainly not the norm anymore. About being employed, you want to avoid using that term, because it means federal government employment. That's why they can say that employers must do this and must have quotas and must comply to these things, because they're talking about themselves. They're saying the federal government must be an equal opportunity employer and that sort of thing. So go to independent contractorship. There are many common law forms available to get this done between you and those who would pay for your labor. Next caller.
Also, if you're employed, you're an employee, and if you're an employee, you're a taxpayer. There's no way you can get out of paying your income taxes, and that was made clear in the last couple of nights. You guys aren't listening very closely. You've got to listen. You've got to study. You've got to learn. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
We've gotten ourselves into this problem, you know, by not being aware of information you've, you know, told us about the last couple of nights
right.
and so forth. And, you know, it's our duty to learn about these things and to extricate ourselves, hopefully.
Yes, sir.
Now, what can we do to protect our children? What I mean by that is, you know, I have two small children expecting another. You know, things like practical information, like not getting them Social Security numbers.
Right.
Could you speak to that, things about birth certificates we might or should know about or not know about, or
sure.
things we should sign their names to or not sign their names to? I've never, when people discuss this type of topic, they've never touched on, you know, the children. How can we, you know, I guess children are sovereign citizens. I guess, you know, that.
Certainly. It's very difficult to avoid the birth certificate thing if your children are born in a hospital. And it's also difficult to avoid them automatically being assigned a Social Security number. Since 1987, the government has so-called required your dependents to have Social Security numbers. That's what they say. It's not quite true. If you have a reasonable excuse not to give them a number or let them be assigned a number, such as a religious excuse, moral grounds, religious grounds, and anybody that knows Revelation and the Mark of the Beast knows what I'm talking about here, the IRS will accept that. What they want is, well, if you're still filing and you have to declare them as dependents, what they want is proof that you have children, these are your kids, and you're not assigning them Social Security numbers because of religious or moral grounds. They will accept that. As far as birth certificates, avoiding all that, it's much easier, and I know many people, many of my readers, are home birthing these days with midwives. Check into that. It's very private. Only you and your family know about your kids, and perhaps we can have a secret generation born out there that will surprise the government in a few years.
A lot of the problems that you all have are stemming from greed and from fear. If you have a child you want to get out of the system, don't claim them as dependents. Mm-hmm. Don't scratch your greed. Allow the child to be free. And if you have to pay more taxes because you trapped yourself, so be it.
Excellent point. Yeah.
Don't enslave your children because you screwed up. Good evening. You're on the air.
I have a CD. It's great. It's one of my favorite. I recommend y'all getting it too. Next caller.
Oh, we don't have a caller for one call.
Okay. We need some callers here. The number again is 602-337-24. What is the number?
2524. We don't need callers. We got plenty of callers. We just have to wait until somebody rings the bell.
Okay.
Good evening.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, I've been listening to your show. I enjoy it. I had a couple of quick questions. One is, IRS is sending me these summonses, and I have no idea if they're legitimate summonses.
Right.
And they're threatening if I do not show up that all kinds of evil things will happen to me.
Certainly.
And could you comment on that?
Well, these summons, as my understanding goes, generally do not have the force of law. They're basically saying, we really want you to come in and tell us all these things about yourself so we can use them against you. Two ways to go about this. You can show up, take your records with you, but not reveal them to the IRS. They admit that themselves in their own special agent's manual. I talk about that in my book. Or two, you can refuse to show up, as I talk about how in the book, and then the IRS has a dilemma. Well, do we want to go to court and get a judge to force appearance or not? You know, what are the ramifications of that, trying to force someone? What are they going to say about it? How much stink is he going to raise? So this whole thing, the summons enforcement is by no means certain, and you've got two options for your benefit. So get my book, because it talks about that in Chapter 25.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
It's also important, folks, if you get a summons and it's signed by a judge, you do have to go, and you do have to bring whatever they say that you have to bring. But you do not have to show them anything. Mm-hmm. What you should do is put a tape recorder on the table, tell them that you're going to tape every word that is spoken, start the tape recorder recording, identify yourself, ask them to identify themselves, and then the next question out of your mouth mm-hmm. should be, do you, as a representative of the United States government in the capacity that you claim, have a delegation of authority? If the answer is no, tell them that you have satisfied the summons, you have showed up with your records, you refuse because you do not have to, under the law, show them or tell them anything, and that you're going home. And then go home. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, God bless, Bill. Thanks for putting on this series. Great job. Mr. Party.
Yes, sir.
Sure appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
Going back to something you discussed last night about people who had voluntarily, signed a contract with the IRS
mm-hmm.
to pay back taxes,
right.
catch up on filings and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's something that I have done out of ignorance, but, before I knew any better, I
sure.
think it was the right thing to do. But now it's coming up time to file again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I kind of got the indication from you that you should go ahead and follow through with the contract that you had signed with them, because it's something that you had already done.
Unless you can allege fraud on their part.
Right. Unless right. you want to challenge it on the fraud basis.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is completely legitimate in my way of thinking, but involves...
What's your question?
Taxes are coming due again. Can I go ahead and file my affidavit and everything like that and still continue paying the debt that I've obliged myself to pay?
Well, the two will contradict themselves. If you file the affidavit saying, I've been tricked into this and I never was required to pay, and I only did this out of ignorance and fraud and intimidation, but yet you still continue to pay, your left hand is not agreeing with your right hand. The most important thing in all this, dealing with the government and filing papers and all this sort of thing, is to be consistent, okay? Because they'll look for inconsistencies and they'll say, you're not sincere about this, or you don't know what you're doing. So either pay and keep paying and pay off the thing, or allege fraud, as is talked about in affidavits, and go that way. But don't mix the two.
You're the last caller. Please make your question short and to the point.
Okay. Yeah, hello, Bill, and hello, Mr. Party.
Hello.
Have the book. Have your book.
We need your question, please. We're at the end of the hour.
If the husband sends in the affidavit and so forth, does the wife also need to...
Have you all filed jointly?
Previously, but only I earned income last year.
Right. Well, if you filed singly this past year, you can file your affidavit, and she doesn't have to. It's best if you're in agreement about this, just for yourselves and your marriage, and also your stance against the government. But it's not necessary. Well, that concludes our call-in session. I want to thank everyone that's been listening. I want to thank all the readers out there who have ordered the book, and I appreciate all the letters and support you've given me. My next edition will be out next year sometime, and you'll be hearing more about that. I'll be on the show, I'm sure, when that's imminent. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for coming. It's been a great three nights. I'm sure everybody out there has learned an awful lot, not even 1/1000th of what they can learn by reading your book. But for those of you who would like to acquire, it's $43. Make checks or money orders out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E, nothing else, just Annie. $43, send it to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's the Intelligence Service, P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Again, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Bill, for having me.
You're always welcome back. Good night, folks.
Good night.
God bless you all.
War's over, man. Wormer dropped a big one.
What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
Germans? Forget it, he's rolling.
It ain't over now. 'Cause when the going gets tough. The tough get going. Who's with me? Let's go. Come on.
Yeah. Let's go. Hey, get him. Oh, let's go.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to The Hour of the Time, the only place left in the world where you can get real truth in media. We broadcast on Galaxy 3, Transponder 17, wideband audio, and WWCR 5.065 megahertz worldwide shortwave radio.